Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet and publisher Michael Czarnecki. Czarnecki has written poetry for over 45 years. He has released many collections, including Arcadia Cycle, Sea Smoke and Sand Dollars, and Simple Life, Simple Poems. In 1986, he founded Foothills Publishing and has published the work of hundreds of poets and more than 300 chapbooks and poetry collections. Czarnecki has given readings and conducted workshops all over the Northeast and has been a poet in residence in many regional schools. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Tish. Yeah, beautiful autumn day, too.
Yes, you know? It is. Perfect for a poet.
Yes. Yeah, it's my favorite season, too.
Now, you've said that you sometimes think that the most important thing we do in our lives is to create, whether it's poetry or children or love. Now, is that what got you into poetry?
Not when I first started, but it was a magical moment. That first poem I wrote was in high school, junior year of high school in Buffalo, and Mr. Kerr was my teacher, and we were studying American poetry and Whitman, Sandburg, Frost, Rachel Lindsay, name you don't hear that often anymore.
Yeah.
And a couple of days we went over the lyrics of contemporary songs as poetry. I remember I brought in the lyrics to Masters of War, right?
Oh, yeah.
And wonderful poetry in some of those lyrics. And then the next day my teacher said, okay, in class, I want you to write a poem today. And I had never done that. And I sat there thinking, what do I write about? And suddenly an idea came to me and the words flowed. And I remember so clearly when I finished that poem, and it was the first one I had ever written in my life, I just quietly whispered to myself, wow, I wrote a poem.
Wow.
And I haven't stopped since.
Oh, that's a magical moment then for you, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. And years later, you know, as I started really working as a poet, and that took a long time. It took me 18 years from writing that poem to ever sharing a poem in public. Which I could never do it. I was shy.
But quiet. You were writing during all that time.
Writing all the time, but you know, it was for myself or maybe a close friend or you know whatever, and I wouldn't share it very often. And I finally got up and the first poem I ever read in public was actually to the Bath Peace Group, and I was so inspired by one of the programs about acid rain that I wrote this long 10-minute poem. The next program, I asked the two people I knew, could I possibly read this poem before the program starts? And I did, you know, shaking, you know, nervous, uh-huh. You know, but I knew it would be slow, clear, loud. And afterwards, the guest speaker got up. And this is my first feedback. 18 years took to go public. My first feedback. He gets up and very seriously says, you call that a poem?
Oh, no.
Poems are supposed to rhyme. And at that point, I knew that was his problem. You know, he wasn't listening to any of the internal rhyme.
You know. Oh, yeah. Modern poetry.
Yeah, and if it was 2 or 3 years earlier, that might have sent me right back into the closet, but it didn't, you know.
Yeah.
Because I had confidence enough in myself, even though I had never shared orally. And sometime after that, within a year, formed Foothills Publishing. And as I went along and then quit doing other work just to do the creative work, and I realized, you know, maybe the most important thing is creativity, you know.
Yeah.
And like you said, you know, I've mentioned, you know, whether it's poems or artwork or music or children or love, when you create something, you bring something new into the world that didn't exist before.
Yeah, and you bring part of yourself with it.
Yeah.
You know.
And you hope that connects with others, you know.
Well, tell us why you think the language of poetry so captured your imagination. What is it? It is a different language.
Well, first, because I can't sing, I can't draw. You know, I was stuck with words. You know, I was stuck with words. And it was the magic of those words of those poets we read in high school and junior year, you know, Whitman, Frost. I mean, Frost was one of my early influences, obviously. And there was just something said in poetry that wasn't being said in prose for me. And then the real important shift, you know, after Frost, there was Robinson Jeffers, an influence, Gary Snyder. And then it shifted in the 70s. I shouldn't say shifted because those other poets are still influences. But I discovered through Snyder the Japanese and Chinese poets.
Yeah.
And, you know, back in the 70s, you know, back in the late 70s. And, you know, I was reading a poetry that I knew I connected strongly with, different than a lot of American poetry, contemporary American poetry. And that's when it really clicked for me that, you know, this is my voice, too.
Yeah. I know. Well, that kind of all poetry takes you deeper into your soul and helps other people uncover themselves in some ways.
You hope for that.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, I've been, you know, working as a poet for decades now. And, you know, I travel all around the country, actually, giving readings and workshops. And every once in a while, you get this comment back from somebody, you know, like one of my books, you mentioned Simple Life, Simple Poems. That's a book from 2001, I think. And a friend of mine had it at her house, and an old college friend of hers was visiting, someone she's known for 40 years, see occasionally. And this person was at the house, and my friend was fixing some food in the kitchen, and the friend picked up my book, Simple Life, Simple Poems, and was sitting down reading it, and then suddenly put the book down and said to my friend, "I just read something in this book that makes me know I have to change my life."
Wow.
It's like, yes, wow, you know, and you know, things like that. Every once in a while you hear back from somebody about an experience like that. And, you know, it's, what else could we ask for?
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. Now, I do want you to read a short work from The Spirit of Tao Ching and to tell us a little bit about your influence with this poet, too. And the poem that I want you to read is called The Echo of What Has Passed.
Yeah, okay. Tao Ching was a poet from 360 to 420 or so A.D. in China. He, one of the many great Chinese poets, and I discovered him in the late 70s. And he was considered the first poet of farms and fields. And for a while, I aspired to be like him because, you know, in China, if you were a poet, you worked for the government. I didn't want to do that. That's not what I wanted to do. But he, at the age of around 43, retired. He was tired of bowing down to inferior superiors.
Oh.
And he went back home. And for the rest of his life, he grew rice and vegetables, wrote poems, and drank wine. And I said, I could do that.
How romantic
I could do that
sounds.
Yeah. And I, actually, at 43 is when I quit doing other work. I was selling wine for Heron Hill Vineyards, wonderful winery, but it was a job, you know. And I realized I was 43, and there's probably less time ahead than behind in my life, and I should be doing what's important to me.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, I quit selling wine just to do the creative work. Unfortunately, my wife was very supportive of that. You know, we had one child and another one in the belly at that point and no extra money. But Tao Ching was that influence. And the book, In the Spirit of Tao Ching, it's a collection of five poets' work. Charlie Rossiter from Chicago, he's the editor. And he was up on Wheeler Hill, where I live, a few years ago, and he's visited a number of times. But a few years ago, he suggested, you know, Michael, we should put a collection together of American recluse poetry, because Tao Ching has been an influence on so many people. So I said, yeah, well, let's go. Eventually, I said, let's, you know, go ahead, go for it, Charlie, you know. So in this book, there's my poems, Charlie Rossiter, David Budbill from the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, Antler from Wisconsin, and Sam Hamill. And it's a wonderful collection of poetry. And all of these poets really are American recluse poets. You know, not that we all live a recluse life, but certainly our poetry reflects that little bit of, you know, detachment from the world and that.
Yeah.
So this poem was actually written a long time ago, but it's a good introduction poem to my sequence of poems in that book for Tao Ching. And those are all newer poems, but this is the older one. And it's called The Echo of What Has Passed. Tao Ching would understand. I sit drinking wine, chanting poems, dreaming of mountains. Bills pile high at the door, white hairs infiltrate my beard. Daughter approaches womanhood, young son no longer crawls. Late autumn, already snow has covered the ground. Sipping wine, I shiver as a cool breeze caresses me from behind.
That's great. What a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
You can feel the coolness and the you know, the calmness of your spirit.
And it's getting towards, well, it's early autumn, but late autumn isn't far away.
It's coming.
I'm getting a little anxious about it for various reasons.
Yeah, well, we will talk about some of those reasons. But tell us how you were able to just form this publishing house, Foothills Publishing. How did you dare to start doing that?
Yeah, that's an interesting story because just like talking with Nate here, he didn't intend to be a recording engineer. I had no dreams about being a publisher. But after I read that first poem in public in 1985, I got involved with a wonderful poetry group in Hornell, New York. I live about 30 miles from Hornell in Steuben County up in the hills. And B. O'Brien was running something called Poets Theater. Mm-hmm. And I started going to that. And I was hearing poets who were wonderful, and they didn't have books out.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's such a shame, you know. And I never really thought about publishing. But at the same time, at Poets Theater, I met Walt Franklin, a wonderful poet and essayist. And he was publishing a little bit of poetry under Great Elm Press. And we had common interests, bioregionalism, the natural world. And so we started publishing together. Our first book that we published was called Susquehannock, a literary anthology of the Upper Susquehanna Watershed.
Wow.
And we both live in the northwestern corner of the Susquehanna Watershed. And that was in 1986. And then we co-published a few chapbooks together. But then I had interests that were broader than just bioregionalism and that. And I decided to, you know, continue publishing on my own, just Foothills Publishing imprint. And it was mainly because I wasn't hearing poets were published, you know. And, you know, it's, and Bruce Bennett was one of our early poets,
yes.
Catherine Mahan.
Yes.
We did, I think, possibly the first chapbook of her Red Wing poems, you know, which, and this was back in the 80s, the later 80s. And, you know, Howard Nelson, I don't know if you know.
I do. Yeah. He's been on the show. Absolutely.
Well, he was reading at Poets Theater one time when I was in the audience, and he read two poems from a little sequence of poems called Singing Into the Belly, about their last child and the view of the father of the pregnancy and birth.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved those poems. And we were out at the bar afterwards. I said, hey, Howard, how many poems in that sequence? You know, and he said, well, I forgot, maybe it was 12 or so. I said, that'd make a beautiful chapbook. And we ended up publishing and went out of print, you know, eventually. But it was just that there were so many. And I realized after I started reading poems in public that poetry is an oral art.
Oh, well, absolutely.
And I love the oral, but why weren't these poets having chapbooks, you know? And so I felt I could do something about that.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. What,
does Foothills have a philosophy or themes that you're particularly attracted to?
Well, I certainly have some for my own self, but I've tried not to let my influences be, this is just what Foothills Publishing does. I mean, we published a chapbook of sonnets of Catherine Mahan's. You know, I don't write sonnets. You know, I'm not a formalist poet. You know, but if the poetry is good, if it's speaking to me, no matter what form or what the topics are, I think it should be out there in print. And so, I mean, if you look at our titles, and now it's actually over 400 chapbooks and full-length books.
Wow.
I mean, a wide variety, you know, of themes. There's really no one focus of Foothills. My heart lies with the natural world. My heart lies with bioregionalism. Yeah, you know, that's always there. But it's broad interest. You know, to me, it's what can I do to help poets who are serious about their work and good to get their work out into the public a little more.
And it's so important to give people their voice in that way. Yeah. Now, I do want you to read some short untitled pieces from the Dao Jin work.
Okay.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about it first?
Yeah, just when we decided to put this book together, I didn't want to use any old poems, so I worked on a series of newer poems. And in the book, there's a sequence of 15 poems of mine that were written for this book. And I wrote them all in eight lines. Old Chinese form, there'd be four-line, eight-line poetry and couplets. And so I wrote all of these in eight-line verses, and they don't rhyme, though. Okay. So, yeah, I'll read those. There's a few of these here. And one other comment, too. Most of these poems are set on Wheeler Hill, where I live, very rural and remote, you know. So, number two. Hilltop covered in thick fog, nearby trees barely in view. No sunrise over eastern ridge, only slow lightening of sky. Cat meows, wanting food in his dish. Homemade bread, toasting on wood stove. Would you understand if I said, right here, the center of the world? Three. And most of our neighbors are Old Order Amish, so this is referring to that. Our neighbor comes for a visit, horse-pulled cart with empty milk cans. I put on shirt, step through door, greet him as I walk on porch. We talk of weather, this drought, accident that stole seven Amish lives. Meanwhile, kingbirds hunt from small trees. Hummingbird hovers at feeder. And five. This will be soon. Winter's first flakes begin to fall. Long season looming ahead. As snow deepens, we become more isolated, inaccessible. Few visitors come to see us. Who wants to walk long pathway in? In this moment, all that I need, family, books, cup full of sake. 9. Here on remote Wheeler Hill, apart from that other world, so too most of my neighbors, Old Order horse and buggy Amish. When I venture into Valley, I wonder what news will greet me. Too often, news of regret. Why do I ever leave this hill? And the last one, number 15. Long ago, I went out on road, hitchhiked 30,000 miles, backpacked for days in mountains, hiked along rocky ocean shore, met strangers who became friends, women who became lovers. All this lies in the past. Yet I wonder, what adventures still lie ahead?
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet and publisher Michael Czarnecki. He's the publisher of Foothills Press. Tell us about your homestead, Wheeler Hill, and then we'll talk about this huge thing that changed your life.
Sure. Wheeler Hill is Steuben County, about 12 miles north of Bath. We live on top of the hill. It's a long ridge, actually. We're about 2,000 feet elevation, and we have 50 acres up there. We've been living on the hill since 1984. We had two other smaller properties. Even though I've never had much money, we've always worked out some way to purchase some land. Mm-hmm. So these 50 acres are, you know, a beautiful place, and our house site is a third of a mile from the road. And for a long time, we lived in an old mobile home there, and it was getting worse and worse. And 7 years ago, we ended up building a house. Our Amish neighbors did a house raising for us.
That's great.
And, you know, it's this place that we have poetry readings every year, late summer, early fall, and gatherings of folks and pots of soup and beverages and just all afternoon poetry. And it's very special to a lot of people. You know, it has become over the years. Yeah, and a couple of months ago, a little over 2 months ago, we had a house fire, and we lost everything, complete. I mean, it wasn't just our personal possessions. It was all of Foothills Publishing, all of our equipment, all of our archival books, and it was devastating. And we were in Maine, while my wife and I and Chapin, my younger son, who's 17, we were just getting to Maine. We were going to Acadia, which is my spiritual home, and we got a phone call from my son, who was home, and said that the house was on fire.
God, that must have been unbelievable.
Luckily, he woke up. The flames are like 5 feet away from him when he woke up. But, you know, here we are in Maine, and he was okay, you know, which, you know, obviously the very first, you know, thing of concern. But everything is total loss, and you never expect something like that to happen. You know, I lost decades of journals, handwritten journals. We lost, like I said, the archive, all of our books, everything. And, you know, I realized afterwards, you know, after I got over the shock of it and that, you know, it is just material stuff, though. You know, and yes, those journals are gone. I've got remnants of them. You know, some
smoke-covered
ink run. Some you can't read most of them, but there's a page or two here or there, or a few pages. So I treasure those little glimpses,
yeah,
you know, from the past.
Messages from the rubble.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, there was an art auction in Corning to benefit us. In a minute, I'll mention that. But a friend of mine in Montana, I sent her six of these fragments of old journals, and she created these six pieces of artwork, you know, encaustic art,
wow,
where she encased those in the hot wax and that, and beautiful pieces. And what a way to preserve these little remnants as a new form of art, you know, new piece of art. And right here in Ithaca, Laura Glenn, wonderful artist and poet.
Oh, yes.
We published Laura. Well, she took also a couple of pieces of my old journals and did these beautiful digital photographs that were just so many comments when they were on display at the auction, you know, just beautiful work. So that was interesting to me, you know, to take these scraps of this disaster and then have this art created, you know, from that, using that as the base, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I've been amazed, not amazed, that's the wrong word, but I've been overwhelmed with the support we've received from so many people since this disaster. You know, we had no insurance and no money.
Oh,
and
gosh.
We've been hearing
but
from...
But you've gathered so many people around your life.
Exactly. And, you know, I've always been an optimistic person, and I've always known that people are good. And whenever something negative happens, you know, people-wise, I always take it that's an exception, you know. And mm-hmm. But it's been humbling to see the outpouring of support we've had from people all around the country, people we don't even know. You know, somebody from Nebraska sent a note, I've never met you, I don't know you, but I've always admired what you've done with Foothills Publishing,
oh,
sent a small check, you know.
Well, how has this affected you as a poet? Do you know yet? I know it's still probably fresh.
Yeah. No, I don't know yet. You know, I've written a couple of bad poems since it happened. You know, it's like I'm going to need some space and distance. You know, certainly as a human being, it's affected me. And I know certainly I'm sure will affect some of the poetry that comes from this at all. But I'm still right now I'm turning 12 different directions every day. There's so much to do. And actually, October 2nd, we're going to be having a house raising. We've got almost all the lumber there, and our Amish neighbors, 40 to 50 of them, are going to come over and raise a house in a day. So, yeah, it's like I never would have thought we would be at that point when this fire happened. And again, it's just because of the overwhelming generosity of so many people.
Yes. God, so art is coming out of this, these flames.
Yeah.
It's because of you, Michael.
Yeah. Well, I love what I do. I tell people I'm not fit to do anything else anymore. You know, I mean, this is it. This is
you
what
have
I do.
To.
And I love it. And, I also tell people I don't work anymore. You know, I'm doing what I love. And if it's touched people along the way, wow, I feel, you know, just humbled by that.
Yeah. I know throughout your life, as a poet, you've also gone on these poetic journeys.
Yeah.
Are you going to continue doing that, or is this a journey that you're still on and you can't really move away from it?
Well, right now I should have been in Montana. I had a big journey scheduled to Montana and then down to the Southwest, which I've never really been in. I've been down to Carlsbad Caverns and El Paso, but I was going to be in Flagstaff and Tuba City and Phoenix and Albuquerque and Austin and New Orleans and then back home. But I knew as soon as the fire happened, I can't do
that. What are these poetic journeys for? Is it mainly to write or just to expand your mind?
Well, I do two different kinds of journeys. And one is a purposeful journey. And those journeys are like Route 20. I traveled Route 20 from Boston to Oregon. I wrote a book about that, In Haibun, the Japanese condensed prose haiku.
Uh-huh.
And that was back in 96. And that's a journey it goes from here to there. And as I do it, I stay totally focused on the journey. I never turn the radio on, don't play any music. And I try all the time to be involved with the journey. You know, driving, getting out of the car, walking, giving poetry readings.
And so you go by yourself, I assume.
Yeah, I have to. Otherwise, there's too much distraction. So, and I've done a number of those journeys. The Mississippi River from Itasca down to the Delta, Route 2 from Maine to Washington, Route 62, Niagara Falls to El Paso.
So do you make yourself write when you're doing this? Do you feel the pressure of having to record it?
It's no pressure.
No pressure.
This is part of what I do, you know. So the writing comes easily. Not necessarily poetry all the time as I'm on the road, but I keep extensive journals. And then, like, you know, I have a multimedia program of the Route 20 trip I took in spring again last year. And, you know, so I have photos and haiku and stories that I present. Then the other journeys are just reading journeys, going out into the world as a poet, as an oral memoirist. I tell stories from life, too. And those are journeys to go out there with my art, you know, and to share that with people and conduct some workshops and just to connect with other creative people around the country and share what I've done.
Uh-huh.
And that's different. Those, I'll
yeah,
play
those
radio,
are separate.
And I'll listen to Van Morrison on the CD player as I'm driving or something, you know.
Well, I want to have you read a new piece called Observing Monarch that you said that you would like to read for us.
Okay, sure. And monarchs, I mean, we all know what monarchs are, and I'm always amazed with them. And just a couple of weeks ago, if I could have one quick little story, a lot of trees got burned that were near the house. And one of the trees that a lot of leaves are gone, what was left up there were just brown, withered leaves. And about 2 weeks ago, near dusk, hundreds and hundreds of monarchs came to that tree and roosted for the night. And they stayed a bit in the morning because it was cool, but the morning sun hit them. And it was almost like there were these living leaves returning to this tree.
Mm.
You know, it was just, and just for a short period, you know, they were gone the next day after it got warm. But what an amazing experience and sight that was. So this isn't from that experience, but it was written a little bit before that. Observing Monarch. Monarch wings by, lands on goldenrod blossom, flutters off a little farther south, while another takes its place, lands on same stalk. A few seconds of rest, then it too flies off, while I stand marveling at frail creatures, this last generation born here, now turning south, heading far, far away to southern grounds to continue this life journey, while I stand contemplating my life's path for these remaining years ahead, wondering how I'll pass on my life's experience to some watching bystander.
Oh, that's beautiful. A beautiful piece.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about the fact that you've been teaching poetry in the schools for many years. How do you inspire the kids? Or do you even need to? Because children's art I've always found so amazing.
They inspire me.
Yeah.
You know? And I actually don't do very much of that anymore, but I did for a long time. And what was always fascinating is when I'd go into a class, usually the kids who really got onto it were the ones that the teachers thought were the poorer students.
Ah.
You know? It's like, well, I didn't think they'd ever. And there's something about expressing your own self, you know, giving them the permission to express themselves, their feelings, their thoughts, their ideas, that just, you know, some kids really grab onto. And, you know, on the other end of it, some of the kids who are the great, you know, straight A students, it was hard for them sometimes, you know, because they just weren't used to that. And they, you know.
And they're probably thinking they have to be perfect, like it's
exactly,
a test or something.
Yeah. And so that was always a joy when it was those students that just weren't as good, quote unquote, students, really grabbed onto it. And I have some wonderful stories. I could talk for a whole hour about some of the experiences in the schools. But, you know, even now, you know, I'll see students who, you know, I was at the bike shop getting a cable for my son the other day, and I didn't recognize the guy behind the counter. He's mid-20s. He goes, "Mr. Zarnecki, right?" I go, "Yeah, well, how do you know?" He goes, "Well, you were in my third grade."
Wow.
And I said, "You remember that?" He goes, "Yeah, I remember that." You know, it was like really meaningful to me. So, you know, again, you hear this every once in a while. One of my favorite school projects was the Chemung River Project in Elmira for 14 years. I was the poet and naturalist and historian would work with students centered all on the Chemung River. And twice a year, I would take fourth graders out to the river to write. And what a wonderful project that was. You know, it fit in with both the writing and my interest in nature and bioregionalism.
Oh,
and that was one of my favorite projects.
Oh, yeah. But what a way to teach kids, too, with all that experience and, you know, the natural world and the teachers and being able to express themselves all at once.
The one project I still work with, and it's been a long, but otherwise I'm really not doing schoolwork, is with the Corning Children's Center. And I work with 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old children.
Oh, wow.
And that is a whole fascinating thing in itself. And we've been doing that for 14 years, or a long time anyway, you know.
Yeah. How important do you think the oral tradition is in regard to poetry? Do you think it can't have one without the other?
The oral tradition, I'm a publisher, but I'm going to say the oral tradition is more important.
You think so?
You know, I mean, I think so. I mean, the books allow your poetry to be read, you know, by others that you don't see or that, but poetry is an oral art. It started as an oral art. It is an oral art. And yes, the books are important, and I don't want to diminish that at all, since that's half of my life's work is publishing. Books, but poetry is an oral art. And I tell poets that we publish, I said, you know, poetry is a hand sell, too. People aren't rushing to the stores to find books of poetry to read, you know, but if you go out there as a poet and you share your poems orally, you'll move books, you'll sell books, you know. And so, yeah, the oral aspect is very important, certainly.
Yeah. I know I've often had people say, but people want to hear your voice. And then that's exactly what happens when you read it.
Yeah, I was my books were being used, a couple of my books, at a class at St. John Fisher College a few years ago. And after they were looking and studying my poems, I went in to give a reading, and this one student came up to me afterwards. She goes, "You know, I didn't really like your poetry until I heard you."
Ah.
And she goes, "Boy, it just opened up for me after I heard you read your poems."
That's,
you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is that. That's an important aspect of it.
You bring it to life.
Yeah.
Well, Michael Zarnecki, we're almost out of time. Do you want to give some contact information? People can get in touch with you, help you out with your new life that you're trying to create.
Sure. I'd love to. If you go to foothillspublishing.com, all one word, foothillspublishing.com, that will take you to the Foothills website. And I have a website, foothillspublishing.com/poetguy.
Uh-huh. And are you going to be doing any readings in the next month or so?
A lot of them. I don't know if anything close by. I'm at RIT next week, and then the week after that, I'm in the Adirondacks for a few days, Indian Lake and Tupper Lake. So,
but they'll be able to find
the road
find that on your website.
Yeah, if you go to the website, and also I am on Facebook. If anyone wants to search Michael Zarnecki on Facebook, I'm there. I can be found.
Great. Well, Michael Zarnecki, thank you so much, and good luck. Thank you for all the amazing work you do.
Well, thank you so much, Tish. It was great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.